The Fuller Memorandum, Disc 4.
Chapter 7. Beer and Tea. You can focus on thinking yourself into the other guy's shoes until the cows come home, but it's not going to do you a whole lot of good if he's actually wearing sandals. More to the point, what if he's got an entire shoe rack to choose from, and the pair you need is the one that's missing? There is a chicken and egg problem here. Or, more accurately, a sole and bootstrap one, and I'm not going to solve it by sitting in my office. Nor am I going to fix matters by hollering down the speaking tube at the gnomes buried in the stacks, not with just 2 delivery runs a day. On the other hand, if you go and actually look at the other guy's footprints, you might just find something new. And so, in a spirit of inquiry, I set out to burgle Angleton's office. Now, it just so happens that Angleton has officially been declared missing, and I am his assistant trainee T-boy. In a more paranoid working environment, I might just be under suspicion of having disappeared him myself. Perish the thought and pass the ammunition. But Angleton is reckoned to be sufficiently formidable that, well, let's say it's unlikely. Besides, we don't generally play politics with the kid gloves off. There are exceptions, such as the late and unlamented Bridges, but they're exactly that, exceptions. The hard fact is that all the real players can turn the game board into a smoking hole in the map, which generally forces them to tread lightly. Skulking past Iris's office window, I tiptoe around the coffee station and duck down the back staircase, through the fire doors, round the bend, down the fire escape stairs, and then pause outside the unmarked green metal door. I do not encounter anyone in the process, but you can never be sure. There are cameras, and there is internal security, and if you're really unlucky, there are the caretakers from the night shift. This is a security agency, after all. However slipshod and dustily eccentric it might appear at times, you should never take things for granted if you are perpetrating monkey business. I pull out the Necronomipod and fire it up. Happy fun icons glow at me. Safari, YouTube, horned skull, settings, bloody runes, messaging, elder sign. You know the interface. Bloody runes gets me into the ward detector, which is showing the usual options. I point the camera at the door and peer into the shiny screen. Sure enough, in addition to Angleton's trademark screaming mind, someone has ploddingly inscribed a Langford death parrot with a sympathetic link to a web stats counter so they can monitor how many intruders its head crashed from the comfort of their laptop. What are standards coming to? I pause as a nasty thought strikes me, and I triple-check the doorframe, then the ceiling above the entrance, then the other side of the corridor, just in case. But no, nothing. This is strictly amateur hour stuff. So, rather than zapping the LDP, I pull out my conductive pencil and sketch in a breakpoint, and then an exception list with a single item, the signature of my new ward. The screaming mind already knows me well. 3 minutes later, I put the phone away, place my hand on the doorknob, twist, and push. Angleton's office. Here be monsters. Silent and cold, it is home to the ghosts of a war colder by far than the one the ignorant public thought we won in 1989. A room walled in floor-to-ceiling file drawers, a gunmetal desk with organ pedals and teletype keyboard, dominated by a hooded microfiche reader. The silent heart of an intelligence stilled, no longer beating out the number station signals across the iron curtain. I half expect to see cobwebs in the corners, to smell the stale cigarette ash of 1,000 tense nights beneath the Arctic skies, waiting for the bombers. I shake myself. History lies thick as winter snow in this room. I could drown beneath its avalanche weight if I don't pull myself together. And in any case, Angleton was here. In his office, I mean. Not in this actual spot, before the Cold War. I've seen a photograph from 1942, the man himself smiling at the camera, visibly no older or younger than he is today. It's an open question, the extent to which he was involved in the occult affairs of government before the Second World War. Just how far back does he go? Human resources don't have a home address on file, which is itself suggestive. I wonder. Before I sit down behind his desk, I scan the walls, floor, and ceiling up and down with the Necronomipod. Sure enough, certain of the file drawers are booby-trapped with lethal-looking webworks of magic. not drawn in the plodding journeyman hand of the outer door's vandal, but sketched in Angleton's spidery scrawl, complex arcs and symbols linking arcane declarations and gruesome probability matrices. I could reverse engineer them in time, and maybe worm my way inside, but knowing the boss, there's probably nothing there but nitrogen triiodide on the draw rails, and a jack-in-the-box loaded with tear gas. He was a firm believer in keeping the crown jewels in his head, or its annex, the thing in the green metal desk. The Memex. You've got to understand that although I've read about the things, I've never actually used one. It's an important piece of the history of computing, leaked to the public as a think piece commissioned by the Atlantic Weekly in 1945. Most of the readers thought it was a gosh-wow-by-damn good idea, but were unlikely to realize that a number of the things had actually been built, using a slush fund earmarked for the Manhattan Project. The product of electromechanical engineering at its finest, not to mention its most horrendously complex, each Memex cost as much as a B-29 bomber, and contained six times as many moving parts, most of them assembled by watchmakers. It wasn't until HyperCard showed up on the Apple Mac in 1987 that anything like it reached the general public. I believe Angleton's Memex is the only one that is still working, much less in day-to-day use, and to say it takes black magic to keep it running would be no exaggeration. I approach the seat with considerable caution, and not just because I'm absolutely certain he will have taken steps to ensure that anyone who sits in it without his approval and pushes the big red on button will never push another button in their admittedly short life. He knows how to use the thing, but if I crash it or break the cylinder head gasket or something, and he comes back, the only shoes I'd be safe in would be a pair of NASA-issue moon boots, and maybe not even then. I drag the wooden chair back from the Memex. The tiny casters squeak like agonized rodents across the worn linoleum floor, and lower myself gingerly into the cracked leather seat. The oak arms are worn smooth beneath my hands, where his palms have pressed upon them over the decades. I grab the solid sides of the desk and ease myself forward until my feet rest lightly on the pedals. There's an angled glass strip facing me from the far end of the desk, and a light in the legwell that comes on as my heels touch the kick plate. It's a periscope, giving me a view of my toes and the letters at the back of each pedal. I turn the gunmetal turret of the microfiche reader towards me, place the Necronomipod on the desktop, and push the power button. There's a clunk of relays closing, and then a thrumming vibration runs through the machine. It's easy to forget that though it weighs more than a ton, its average component weighs less than 2 grams. The gears alone took 2 months' entire output from the largest watch factory in America. I stare into the hooded circular screen in something like awe. Machined to sub-micron precision, yet less powerful than the ancient 68EC00 in my washing machine, these devices were the backbone of the laundry's intelligence analysis section in the late 1940s. It's like a steam locomotive or a stone axe. Just because it's obsolete doesn't make it any less of an achievement, or any less fit for purpose. The screen lights up. Not like an LCD monitor, or even an old cathode ray tube, but more like an antique film projector. Write username. The moment of truth. I cautiously kick type Bob, then spend a fruitless minute hunting for the return key before I realize there's a paddle-shaped lever protruding level with my left knee, like the handle on a manual typewriter. I nudge it. There's a clunk from inside the desk, and the injunction vanishes, to be replaced by a picture of the organization coat of arms. Then more words appear, scrolling in from the bottom of the screen, wobbling slightly. Write clearance. What the hell? I laboriously type bloody Baron and knee the return paddle. There's something weird about the foot keyboard. Then I twig to the fact that its abbreviated supply of characters means it's probably a Baudot code system. Which figures? Older than ASCII. The screen fades to white after a couple of seconds. Then a bloody sigil flashes into view. It doesn't kill me to look at it, but the disquieting sense that the void is inspecting the inside of the back of my skull makes me squirm on my seat. There is an eye-warping loop to one side of it that feels familiar, as if it's tied to my soul somehow. Right. Still alive? Y/N. Knees knocking, I type Y. Return. Welcome, Bob. You are authenticated. If you are reading this message, I am absent. Welcome to the dead man's boots. Hope you don't find them too tight. You are one of only four people who have access to this machine, and at least two of them are dead or dying of K syndrome. You may read all files not flagged with a Z prefix, search all files not flagged with a Z prefix, and print any files flagged with a prefix from A to Q. You may not read or search Z prefix files, print files flagged with a prefix from S to Z, dismantle or reverse engineer this instrument. Warning: lethal enforcement protocols are enforced. Right. Go to main menu. Y/N. This is Angleton. He doesn't bluff. I make a note of those clearances on my phone. Then, hesitantly, I type Y. I have, in fact, seen worse-designed user interfaces. There are abominations out there that claim to be personal media players that... But I digress. The Mimex is a miracle of simplicity and good design, as long as you bear in mind that it's operated by foot pedals, except for the paper tape punch. The display is a microfilm reader, and it can't display more than 10 menu choices on screen at any time. Unlike early digital computers such as the Manchester Mark I, you don't need to be Alan Turing and debug raw machine code on the fly by flashing a torch at the naked phosphor memory screen. You just need to be able to type on a Baudot keyboard using both feet, with no delete key and lethal retaliation promised if you make certain typos. There's nothing here that's remotely as hostile as VMCMS to a Unix hacker. I've just got an edgy feeling that Memex is reading me and sitting in quietly humming judgment. So I spend half an hour reading the quick start guide, and then... Right, document to retrieve. I find the shift pedal, kick the Memex into numerical entry mode, and type fetch 10.0.792.560. Not found. Right, document to retrieve. Shit. I try again. Fetch index. There is a whirring and a chunking sound from within the desk. Aha. After several sluggish seconds, a new menu appears. Right, enter document code number. Fetch 10.0.792.560. More whirring and a brief pause. Then the screen clears to display everything the Memex knows about the missing file. Document index entry. Number 10.0.792.560. Title: The Fuller Memorandum. Deposit date: 6 December 1941. Storage location: Stack Vault 10.0.792.560. Copy status: Forbidden. Classification: Beyond Top Secret, Z Clearance. Expiration: Does not expire. Code words: Teapot, White Baron, Case Nightmare Green. See also: Z Angleton, Z Execution Protocols, Z Final Exit. End of index entry. Classified: S7647. Dear John, once again, greetings from Ravel. I hope you can forgive my lack of enthusiasm. It's godforsaken cold here in January. I thought I knew what winter was. Moscow in winter is enough to teach anyone a grudging respect for Jack Frost, but this is absolutely unspeakable. There are few railways in Estonia, and those which remain after the armistice are under military control to deter any passing fancy that might occur to Comrade Trotsky in his spare time. I'm sure we shall not be invaded again, at least before he has finished pacifying Siberia, but one can hardly blame Mr. Peep for his caution. I have a most unexpected cause to write to you. A gift horse just presented its head at my transom window. Such a gift horse was this that it would be insane not to look it in the mouth. But I have inspected its back teeth, and I assure you that the mare is, although middle-aged, by no means anything other than that which it appears to be. Namely, the bereaved mother of the prodigal we were discussing in our earlier correspondence. It seems that my sympathetic questioning made more of an impression on Madame Heuningen-Höhner than I imagined. There was a brief thaw in the bitter cold we have lately been experiencing, and being of a mind to visit the capital for a few weeks, she took advantage of it. She is even now ensconced in our parlour, where Yevgenia is entertaining her. And the prodigal son's fossil collection? Take them, she cried. Oscar told me how they caught your fancy. Perhaps you know of a curator in London who will put them to some better use. Vile things. I don't want to remember my son by them. Her man, who was burdened with a heavy box all the way from Rapla to Ravel, can only have wholeheartedly agreed. And so they are even now in a shipping trunk, awaiting more clement weather before I dispatch them to you by sea. Madame Heuningen-Herner is a sensitive soul, and her life has been blighted by domestic tragedy, from her first husband's breakdown and incarceration to the deaths of two baby daughters, and now to the fate that has overtaken her son, however much he might have deserved it. She takes little interest in politics, and is transparently what she is, the daughter of Baron von Wimpfen of Hesse, wife of Baron Oscar von Heuningen-Herner, a devoted family lady. Quite why her life has circled this vortex of unspeakable tragedy eludes her entirely, as does the nature of her privileged upbringing and the precarious status of the Prussian aristocracy in the Baltic states. But she is near to 60, a child of the previous century, and simply unable to adapt to the chill winds of change sweeping the globe. He wrote to me often of his fears and uncertainties, she said, showing me a sheaf of letters. I think she needed to share her pain, that of a mother for her son, the last love and succor of any man, however much of a brute he may be. You see, he was by inclination deeply religious, but unfortunately it brought him much pain. I hold the shamanic Eastern mystics responsible. Vile Orientals. And the Jews. Her aristocratic nostrils flared. If they hadn't fomented this disgraceful revolution, he would not have thought to rise up against the government. Such sentiments are common among the aristocracy here. They have an unhealthy identification with the late Tsar. What did he believe? I asked, as a matter of curiosity. Oh, he took it into his head to convert to a vile farrago of Oriental superstitions, nothing as honest and Aryan as Theosophy. He picked these filthy beliefs up in Mongolia nearly 10 years ago when visiting. He met a witch doctor, by all accounts, a man called the Bogd Khan. She rattled on at some length about this. Would you mind if I read his letters on religion? I asked her, and to cut a long story short, she acceded. I now have not only Ungern Sternberg's fossil collection, inherited from his father, but his surviving letters, those he sent to his mother, and they are very interesting indeed. I attach my admittedly imperfect translation of selected extracts of his letters from 1920. I will forward the originals by separate cover from the fossils. Meanwhile, I strongly recommend that you should motivate your fellows in the order to start searching for the missing teapot. Your obedient friend, Arthur Ransom. There comes a time in every counter-espionage investigation when you have to grit your teeth, admit that you're at your wit's end, admit defeat, and bugger off home for a Chinese takeaway and a night in front of the telly. Then you get a good night's sleep, except for the nocturnal eructations induced by too much black bean sauce, and awaken refreshed and revived and in a mood to do battle once more with bollocks. I have gotten somewhere. I now know that the missing file is called the Fuller Memorandum, which, by a huge leap of inductive logic, I hope I'm not getting ahead of myself here, I deduce is a memorandum by or about F. It was filed in 1941, was absolutely mega top secret burn before reading stuff 65 years ago, and has some bearing on Case Nightmare Green. It's also missing. Those last three facts would be enough to give me industrial-grade stomach ulcers if it was my fault. Luckily, it's not my fault. All I have to do is find Angleton, and I'm sure he can explain it all, and also explain what the flaming fuck it has got to do with Bloody Baron. This much is not time-critical. Getting that Chinese takeaway, with or without black bean sauce, is time-critical, lest I starve to death on the case. Going home and doing sweet, sappy, quality-time things with Mo is time-critical too, lest she files for divorce on grounds of neglect. And so is not having a nervous breakdown while waiting for the Board of Inquiry findings, lest I find myself without a career, in which case they'll put me in charge of pushing that handcart full of dusty files around the department. So I stand up, stretch, push the off button on the Memex, and leave Angleton's lair. I pause briefly in my own rabbit hutch of an office, scan my email, respond to a couple of trivial pestiferations. No, I am no longer in charge of the structured cabling specifications for D-Block. Yes, I am still attached to the International Common Insourcing and Acquisition Standards Committee for my sins in a previous life, No, I do not have a desktop license for Microsoft Office because my desktop PC is a Microsoft-free zone for security reasons. And would you like fries with that? The scanner has finished digesting all those dusty letters from Arthur to John. I squirt the PDFs across to the Necronomipod, and then I grab my backpack and umbrella and head for home. Iris isn't in her office as I pass the window, and Rita on the front desk has pissed off early. Then I check my watch and do a double take. It's 6:40. Shit. Mo will kill me, I think, as I head down the main staircase at a fast clip and barrel through the staff exit. This is London, South Bank, south of the centre, north of Tooting, and west of Wandsworth. Come on, you can alliterate too. Suburban High Street, UK. It is early evening, and the streets are still crowded, but most of the shops are closed. Meanwhile, the pubs are half full with the sort of hardcore post-work crowd that go drinking on a Monday evening. I turn left, walking towards the nearest tube station. It's 15 minutes away, but once it gets this late, there's no point waiting for a bus. This is London. The worst thing that can happen to you is usually a mugging at knife point, and I do my best not to look like a promising victim, which is why it takes me a couple of minutes to realize that I'm being tailed. In fact, it takes until the three of them move to box me in. At that point, disbelief is futile. I've done the mandatory escape and evasion training, not to mention Streetwise 101. I just wasn't expecting to need it here. Two of them are strong, silent types in black leather biker jackets worn over white tees and jeans. They've got short, stubbly blonde hair and the sort of muscles you get when you go through a Spetsnaz training course. Not bodybuilders, more like triathletes. They come up behind me and march along either side, too damn close. The third of them, who I guess is their boss, is a middle-aged man in a baggy Italian suit, his open shirt collar stating that he's off the office clock and on his own time. He slides in just ahead and to the left of thug number one as I glance sideways. He winks at me.
"Please to follow this way," he says.
I glance to my right. Thug number two matches my stride, step for step. He stares at me like a police dog that's had its vocal cords severed. I glimpse his eyes and look away hastily. Shit. "Who are you?" I ask, my tongue dry and stumbling, as Mr. Baggy Suit pauses in the doorway of the Frog and Tourette's.
"You may wish to call me Panin."
He smiles faintly.
"Nikolai Panin. It's not my real name, but it will serve."
He gestures at the door.
"Please allow me to buy you a drink. I assure you, my intentions are honorable."
My ward is itching. Nevertheless, I am disinclined to bet my life on it. Panin, whoever he is a player. His definition of honorable might not encompass allowing me to escape with my life, but he's unlikely to start something in the middle of a pub with an after-work crowd. "Would you mind leaving the muscle outside?" I ask. I assume they're not drinking.
"Нет."
He snaps his fingers and says something to the two revenants. They split, taking up positions to either side of the street front of the pub.
"After you,"
he says, waving me into the entrance. If I was James Bond, this is the point at which I would draw my concealed pistol, plug both heavies between the eyes, get Panin in an arm lock, and pistol whip some answers out of him. But I am not James Bond, and I don't want to precipitate a diplomatic incident by assaulting the second naval attaché and a couple of embassy guards, or footballers, or whatever, not to mention sparking a murder investigation which would result in the plumbers having to conduct a gigantic and expensive cover-up operation, all of which would come out of my departmental operating budget and drive Iris to distraction. And anyway, everyone knows that you don't get useful answers by torturing people. You get useful answers by making them trust you. "Why don't you talk to them?" I'd ask the committee.
"Because we might unintentionally tell them something they don't already know," said Chaudhry,
after staring at me for a minute as if I'd grown a second head. Fuck that shit, like I said. So I let Panin buy me a pint. "By the way, do you mind if I text my wife to tell her I'm going to be late?" I ask.
"If you think it necessary, but I promise I will keep you only half an hour."
"Thanks." I smile gratefully and whip out the Necronomipod and tap out a text. "Having a beer with Uncle Fester's boss, home late." Panin holds up a purple drinking voucher, and it has the desired effect. Money and a pair of pint glasses change hands. He carries them over to a small table in the back of the pub, and I follow him. Panin's assistants give me a nasty turn, but it seems this is to be a friendly chat, albeit for extremely unusual values of friendly. I keep both my hands on the table. Wouldn't do to give the Spetsnaz goons the wrong idea. I have a feeling it would take more than Harry's AA-12 shotgun to stop them in their tracks.
To health, home, and happiness,
he proposes, raising his glass. I'll drink to that. My ward doesn't nudge me as I bring the drink to my lips. So, I guess you wanted to talk?
Yes.
Panin, having taken a mouthful, puts his glass down.
Do you have any clues to its whereabouts?
Have what? I ask cautiously.
The teapot.
Tea. I take another mouthful of ESB. Pot? There was something about a teapot in those letters, wasn't there? Something Chaudhry said in the meeting, maybe.
It's missing.
Punin sounds impatient.
Your people have lost it, yes?
I decide to play dumb. If any teapots have gone missing, I suppose facilities would be the people who deal with that. Why do you ask?
You're English.
For a moment, Punin looks exasperated. Then he quickly pulls a lid over it.
The teapot is missing,
he repeats, as if to a very slow pupil.
It has been missing since last week. Everyone is looking for it. Us, you, the opposition. You were its last keepers. Please, I implore you, find it. For all our sakes, find it before the wrong people get their hands on it and make tea.
Committed to paper, this dialogue might sound comical, but coming from Panin's mouth, in his soft, clipped diction, it is anything but. I shiver. Ungern Sternberg's teapot didn't get misplaced by accident, I hazard. Panin's response takes me by surprise.
Idiot.
He leans back in disgust, raises his glass, and takes a deep and disrespectful swig.
You are fishing now.
Bother, I've been rumbled. Afraid so. Let me level with you. I know it's missing, but that's all I know. But I'll tell you what, if you can tell me what happened in Amsterdam last Wednesday and why it followed my wife home on Thursday, I would be very grateful. Panin shuts his mouth with a click.
Your wife is unhurt, I hope?
He asks, all nervous solicitude. Shaken, but not stirred. The intruder was attributed to your people. Did you know that?
Not unexpected.
Panin makes a gesture of dismissal with one hand.
They do that, you know, to muddy the waters.
Who? The opposition? Panin gives me that look again, the look you might give to the friendly but stupid puppy that's just whittled on the carpet for the third time that day.
Tell me, Mr. Howard, what do you know?
I sigh. Not much, it seems. I have been seconded to a committee that's trying to work out why you folks are currently running up an eBay reputation score like there's no tomorrow. I'm trying to deal with an unpleasant domestic situation, namely work following my wife home. My boss is out of the office, and I'm trying to pick up the pieces. If you thought you could shake me down for useful information, I'm afraid you picked the wrong spy. I could tell you more than you could possibly want to know about the structured cabling requirements for our new headquarter building's fourth sub-basement, but when it comes to missing teapots, nobody put me on the flash priority classified briefing list.
I see.
Panin looks gloomy.
Well, Mr. Howard, many would not believe you, but I do. So here is my card.
He passes me a plain white business card, unprinted on either side, but pressed from a very high grade of linen weave. It makes my fingertips tingle.
Should you have anything to discuss, call me.
I slide it into my breast pocket. Thanks.
As for the teapot, it was never the same after Ungern Sternberg retrieved it from the Bogd Khan's altar.
He's studying my face. I do my best not to twitch. I've heard those names before. I'll keep my eyes open for it, I reassure him.
I'm sure you will,
he says gravely.
After all, it would be in everyone's best interests for the teapot to return to its rightful office.
He drains his beer glass.
I will see you around, I am sure,
he says, rising. Bye. I raise my glass to his back as he turns towards the door, shoulders hunched. Classified, S-7647, Annex A.
Dear Mother, salutations from Urga. I greet you as Khan Sternberg, outstanding prosperous state hero of Mongolia, first warlord and general of the Living Buddha and Emperor of Mongolia, His Holiness Bogdjebtsung Damba Kutuktu. Great events, bloody battle, heroic struggle, and glorious victory have contrived to elevate me to the threshold of my destiny as inheritor of the empire of Genghis Khan. It is spring in Mongolia, and already I have purged this land of Bolsheviks, terrorists, and subhumans. Soon my armies will commence their march on St. Petersburg to restore the blessed Prince Michael to his rightful throne and to cleanse Mother Russia of the depravity of revolution and the filthy degenerates who have turned their back on the Holy Tsar. Once I have restored the Tsar, I consider it my duty to retake those lands that have been stolen from the Empire, including our homeland. I trust you will think kindly of me for raising the yoke of anarchist tyranny from the necks of the true aristocracy of Estonia, when I come to purify the Baltic lands and restore the just weight of monarchy to the upstart Poles. The conquest of Urga presented me with a considerable challenge, and I shall describe it for you. Urga lies in a valley between hills, along the banks of the Tula River. When I laid siege to it, the river was frozen, but the degenerate Chinese occupiers had constructed trenches, barricades, and barbed wire defenses around Upper Maimaichang.
Lengthy description of the siege of Ulaanbaatar, 1920.
Now, here is a curiosity. When we stormed the palace of the Bogd Khan to take the Living Buddha from his Chinese captors, the fighting was fierce. After liberating His Holiness, my men executed a tactical withdrawal. But once His Excellency was safe, when I ordered the main attack on the Chinese host occupying the city, I detailed a reliable man, my ensign Yevgeny Budakovsky, who the men call Teapot, to secure the treasury against looters. It is a sad fact that Reds and Wreckers are everywhere. And in these degenerate times, the swine I have to work with, rejects and deserters of the once great army, are as likely to turn to banditry and crime as to bend the neck before my righteous authority. Budakovsky is a stout fellow, a Cossack, powerful and broad-chested, with a little curly blonde head and a narrow forehead. He always does what I ask of him, which is a blessing, and if there is one man I would trust to stand guard on a treasure house for me, it is he. During the occupation, Teapot set his 16 men to stand guard with bayonets fixed outside the great hall, where the treasures and gifts of 500 lamassaries are kept. It is a remarkable place, a museum of wonders unknown in all of Europe. There is a library with shelves devoted to manuscripts in a myriad of languages, and there are chests full of amber from the shores of the northern sea, carved walrus and ivory tusks, rings with sapphires and rubies from China and India, rough diamonds the size of your fingertip, bags of golden thread filled with pearls, and side rooms filled with cases containing statues of the Living Buddha made from every precious material under the sun. Now, Teapot is among the most obedient of my officers, but in the course of restoring order to the city and chasing the remaining enemy rabble out into the wilderness, it was some days before I could return with the Bogd Khan to inspect his treasures. In that time, I am afraid to say that he disgraced himself. Teapot did not steal the Buddha's treasures, else I would have hanged him as high as any other wretch, but he idly looked through the library, and I fear what he did may turn out for the worse in the long run. There are, as you can imagine, scrolls and books unnumbered in there, and they include the most remarkable works of sorcery and prophecy imaginable. All the numerous punishments of hell that are reserved for souls who indulge in the sins of the flesh are documented and indeed illustrated in the finest, one might almost say pornographic, detail. It was to these works that Teapot allowed his salacious imagination to draw him. It is not clear exactly when Teapot found the scroll, but 2 days after the fall of the palace, his sergeant was dismayed to come upon him lying on the floor of the library, crying inarticulately and clutching a crumpled fragment of scripture in his chubby hands. According to the other witnesses, who I have questioned diligently, Teapot showed other signs of distress, bleeding from the eyes, moaning, and clutching his belly. They put him to bed in the hospital, supervised by Dr. Klingenberg, who was minded to euthanize Teapot to spare him from this misery. But wiser counsel prevailed, and my Cossacks continued to care for him until he began to recover the following day, babbling in tongues and occasionally ululating, "Aiya, aiya."
On the third day, just as I was on my way back to the palace, Teapot is said to have sat up in bed, whereupon he asked, "What year is it?" Upon being told it was 1920, he collapsed in a dead faint. And although he is now back at his duties, he is not the same. There is a cold intellect in him that was hitherto absent. Before, he was a loyal brute, but limited. He gave no thought to the morrow. Now he anticipates my orders with eerie efficiency, organizes the men under his command to meet any contingency, shows an unerring ability to sniff out spies. Indeed, he has begun to unnerve me, the more so since I discovered he has other qualities. It is commonplace for war to degrade a good man to the level of a brute, but unique in my experience for it to elevate one such as Ensign Budakovsky. Consequently, I would like to ask a favor of you, dear mother. Enclosed with this letter, I send a copy of the Buddhist scripture that so turned Teapot's mind. It is written in an archaic dialect of Barga Buryat. I have heard that Professor Sartorius of the Schule des Totensprachen in Berlin has some expertise in material of this nature, and I would deeply appreciate it if you could forward the document to him and commission a translation at my expense. This is a matter that I am extremely reluctant to entrust to any of my political associates, for they scheme and plot incessantly, and I am sure there are many who believe that I dabble in the blackest sorcery. I would not like to place such incendiary ammunition in their hands. I implore you not to soil your precious eyes with the contents of this scroll, for it is illustrated with such vile and obscene diagrams that I would be tempted to burn it, were it not for the effect it seems to have on those who read it. But it is for that very reason that I urgently need to obtain the advice of a savant who might tell me what those who read the fragment become. And so, I commit it to your gentle hands. Your loving son, General Baron Ungern von Sternberg.
Chapter 8. Club Zero. I get home an hour and a half late, bone-tired, bamboozled, and bothered. I haven't had a good day at the office, all things considered. A confusing briefing on Russian Okint activities in Western Europe. An old acquaintance who doesn't recognize me anymore. The discovery that the Fuller memorandum is missing, and now Panin's evident patronizing contempt for my lack of insight. I've got a feeling that all the pieces of the jigsaw are within my grasp, if only I could figure out where they lie. Probably dragged under the sofa by an invisible cat, knowing my luck. It's after 8 as I turn my key in the lock, pass my left hand over the ward, and slope into the front hall. The lights are on in the kitchen and there's a pleasant smell. Mo is roasting a chicken, I think. Hello? I call. Up here. She's upstairs and she doesn't sound pissed off, which is a relief. I dump my jacket and take the stairs two at a time. The bathroom door's open and she's stewing herself in the tub in an inordinate amount of green foam and some kind of mud mask so that she looks a little like the creature from the Black Lagoon. Did you get my text? I ask. Yes. Who is the Adams family reference about? I do a double take. What? Oh, shit. I shake my head. Never mind. Obviously, she can't read my mind. Otherwise, there'd have been an artist rifle's brick staking out the pub before I'd taken my first mouthful of beer. I'm losing my touch. I'm screwing up, I admit. You're... Huh. Bet you I've had a more boring day. Boring, maybe. Unproductive, hardly. She snorts and blows a handful of bubbles my way. I spent most of the morning and afternoon sitting on a wooden stool, watching a burned-out 60-something expert mumble into a dictaphone. Then I had to run for a meeting. After that, I looked in on the office, but Mike wasn't there, so I came home. Picked up a free-range bird at Waitrose. It's in the oven now. I was hoping you might want to fix some side helpings. I can do that. I glance at the bath. You going to be long? A half an hour at least. I put the chicken in before I came up here. You want to look in on it in 15 minutes or so. I'd rather spend my time here with her, but I can tell the difference between an order and a request. I sketch a salute. By the way, I say, trying to sound casual about it, I've been stuck with Angleton's work on Bloody Baron, and I'm finding it a bit confusing, and nobody's sent me the briefing papers on the other job yet, the one, you know, last week. She's silent for almost a minute.
Then she sighs. There's a bottle of Bordeaux at the back of the cupboard under the plates and crockery. Open it and give it a while to breathe. Okay. Sorry. I back out of the bathroom, leaving her to try and rebuild the warm, scented bubble that I just burst. I scrub and boil potatoes, then shove them in a roasting pan, check the chicken, chop some carrots, and have the vegetables just about ready when Mo comes downstairs in her bathrobe, hair in a towel. Smells good, she remarks, then looks skeptically at my potatoes. Hmm. She takes over. I get the plates out and pour two generous glasses of wine. It's later than I expected. I'm really rather hungry. Food and wine settle stomach and soul. Neither of us is a very sophisticated cook, although Mo is much more experimentally minded than I am. But we can eat what we prepare for ourselves, which is a good start. And after half an hour, we've methodically demolished half a small roast chicken and a pan of roast vegetables, not to mention most of a bottle of wine. Mo looks content as I shove the plates in the dishwasher and sort out the recyclable bits. You wanted to know what Thursday was about, she says, staring at what's left in her wine glass. I keep running into people who expect me to know. I go in search of another bottle to open. It's not something I can ignore. How much of Club Zero are you familiar with? I'm not. I get the waiter's friend out and go to work on a Pinot Noir. Oh, she pauses. I'm sorry, but are you sure you don't know? Don't know what? I ask irritably as I scrape away the plastic seal on the bottle. Are we in known unknowns territory or unknown unknowns? They're known, okay? She shakes her head. Fucking cultists. Cult? I do a double take. That's Club Zero? She nods. None other. Cultists. They're like cockroaches. We humans are incredibly fine-tuned by evolution for the task of spotting coincidences and causal connections. It's a very useful talent that dates back to the bad old days on the savannah, when noticing that there were lion prints by the watering hole, and then cousin Ugg went missing, and today there are more lion prints and nobody had gone missing yet, was the kind of thing that could save your skin. But once we developed advanced lion countermeasures like stone axes and language, it turned into our secret curse. Because, you see, when we spot coincidences, we assume there's an intentional actor behind them, and that's how we create religions. Nature does weird stuff, so it must be governed by supernature. There's lightning in the clouds. Zeus must be throwing his thunderbolts again. Everyone's dying of plague except those weird folks with the strange god who wash every day. It must be evil sorcery, and so on. Being predisposed to religion has its uses, but it's a real Achilles heel if your civilization is under threat by vastly powerful alien horrors. We have a rich repertoire of primate behavior, which includes the urge to suck up to the big bad alpha male, and a tendency to assume that any intelligence smarter or nastier than we are is the top of the pack hierarchy. Finally, we've got any number of dark religions out there. The followers of Kali or Mictacasihuatl, or the various other faces of the Lady of Death. Certain splinter sects of millennialist Christianity who believe that the revelation of St. John is black propaganda and that Satan will triumph. Strange heresies, byblows of the Albigensians who trace their heritage back to secret cells who worshipped Ahriman in the palace basements of the Persian Empire. Other groups who are less familiar. Syncretistic heresies spawned by bizarre collisions between seekers of hidden knowledge and followers of Tibetan demon princes. And, of course, bat-winged squid gods, although I find it hard to believe that anyone takes that seriously these days. None of their specific beliefs matter. What matters is that if a cell or coven or parish or whatever get their hands on a genuine summoning ritual, the things at the other end of the occult courtesy phone aren't fussy about what they're called, as long as the message is chow time. I take a deep breath. What variety of cult was it this time? The rich American expat kind. She takes a deep breath. American? But didn't the Black Chamber... They didn't lift a finger. Her voice rises. Instead, the dustbin got a reluctant tip-off from the FBI that a bunch of nutty geezmoids from the Every Sperm is Sacred crowd were planning on making a big splash at the UN Population Fund Summit in Den Haag last week. It's not terrorism in America this decade if they shoot doctors or firebomb family planning clinics, you know. I let her simmer for a minute while I pull the cork on the wine bottle and pour the last of the first bottle into her glass. How did it get punted our way?
Chatter and crosstalk.
She drains her glass and shoves it towards me. These aren't your regular godbotherers. They've got form. A history of criminal activity, in other words.
The dustbin and the donut are both keeping tabs on them. They tipped off the Dutch AIVD, which is good, but then they forgot to include us in the loop, which was anything but good. What finally pulled us in was when the AIVD watch team, who were keeping an eye on the 100 kilograms of sodium chlorate and the primer cords they'd stockpiled, noticed the church supplies catalogue and the white goats. The Free Church of the Universal Kingdom.
The Free Church of the what? Mo takes a big mouthful of wine.
The Free Church of the Universal Kingdom. Officially, they're pre-millennial dispensationalists with a couple of extra twists. Subtype, utterly barking and conflicted. Oh, hell. According to their party line, Jesus was just there to set a good example, and we all have the ability to save ourselves. Who will be saved is predestined from the beginning of time. It's their job to bring the church militant to everybody on the planet by fire and the sword, and it gets complicated real fast, in ever-diminishing epicycles of crazy. I swear, the doctrinal differences between some of these schismatic churches are fractal. Anyway, the key insight you need to bear in mind is they're anti-birth control. Very anti-birth control, with overtones of accelerating the second coming by bringing more souls to earth until Jesus can't ignore their suffering anymore. Is this ringing any bells yet? You're telling me they're Case Nightmare Green groupies?
Mo nods vigorously.
They're mesmerised. What they believe doesn't make sense in terms of traditional Christian theology, never mind real-world logic. That's because the outer church is just a cover for something even weirder. The members we were monitoring were labouring under a really horrid glamour, level 4 or higher, I'm not sure.
I shudder. I knew someone with a level 3 glamour about her once. Men would die for a chance to bed her if she crooked her little finger at them, often literally. The theological equivalent, I don't want to think about it.
So, Amsterdam then?
I prompt her.
4 of them were already there. Another 3 flew in the week before. That's why the full dress incident watch was started. AIVD thought it was preparation for an abortion clinic bombing campaign at first, but then the pastor bought a couple of white goats and a penny dropped, and they threw it at France and his friends, who asked us to chip in.
Goats.
Goats, sacrificial, summoning for the purpose of. The watch team were so busy keeping an eye on the explosive stockpile that nobody noticed the metalworking tools and the crucifixes, or the fact that they'd rented a deconsecrated Lutheran chapel 3 months earlier and invited their bishop over for a flying visit. It was only last Tuesday that they put 2 and 2 together and realised what was really going on. That's when they called me in.
She looks bleak and alone, clutching her wine glass as if it's the sole source of warmth in the world.
The bomb was a decoy. It turns out there were 2 cells working, one of whom, Outer Church, didn't know they were set up as a cover story. The other cell, the ones with a goat and a summoning grid in the crypt of the chapel, they were the real operators, initiates of the true faith. They were all set to open a gate to a...
She swallows. I sit down next to her and take her free hand in mine.
I hate those things, she says plaintively.
It wasn't just goats, was it? I probe. The goats were the setup for something else.
The chapel was right next to a nursery school,
she says, and falls silent. Ick is about all I can say to that, so I keep my mouth shut and squeeze her hand gently until she feels like continuing.
We'd picked up a squad of UIM specialists and a police anti-terrorism group who prepared to seal off the area. The trouble is, it was mid-afternoon and the neighbourhood was busy. The last thing you want to do is to run an anti-terrorism exercise next door to a nursery school when the parents are coming to pick their kids up. It's a target-rich zone, and it draws journalists like flies to a sewage farm. So we were going to hold off until evening. But then the Oculus command truck monitors lost the sound from the bugs, and I began to pick up probability disturbances in the vicinity of the chapel, and it looked too risky to hold off. The troops went in, and I followed them. It was unpleasant.
What did they...
They'd built a summoning grid in the altar, and they'd set up a greater circuit with a geodesic pointing straight at the nursery school over the road.
She dry swallows again.
They started with the goats as a warm-up exercise, but there was a homeless woman, and they'd used her as...
Mo gulps, then wipes her lips.
Intestines, ropes and hacks and skeins of a greater circuit made of human guts, still joined to the sacrifice.
She's not swallowing. She's trying not to throw up.
Stop.
I try to let go of her hand. You don't need to go on.
I need to.
She clenches her fist around my fingers and stares at me.
They'd crucified her, you know? The microphones picked up their prayers earlier. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. They meant it literally. I don't know why we didn't hear the screams. I think they might have sedated her first. I hope they did that.
That's a forlorn hope. Pain is a power source in its own right, but I don't remind her of this. She's shaking now.
The gate was open, Bob. I had to go through.
My Joan of Arc. I rescued Mo once, years ago. It's ironic, a real giggle, that she turns out to be stronger and tougher than I am. Would you dive through a steaming intestinal gate into a soul-sucking void, armed only with a violin flensed from the bones of screaming sacrifices? She did, and she kept a lid on it afterwards, a stiff upper lip, while I was shuddering and stressed over what was basically an industrial accident. It's a good thing to put your problems in perspective from time to time, but right now I'd rather not, because I'm doing the comparison right now, and I find I'm coming up so short I'm ashamed of myself.
The things in the cultists' bodies had already eaten the blonde teacher's face and most of her left leg,
Mo tells me earnestly,
but the Somali boy child was still screaming, so I had to go after him.
I feel my gorge rising. Too much. I splash wine into my empty glass and take a too hasty swig.
Jesus, Mo.
Jesus was evidently the wrong word. She stands and manages to make it as far as the doorway, en route to the bathroom, before she doubles over and sprays the wine-soaked remains of her dinner on the floor. I make it to the sink and pull the plastic bowl and the cleaning supplies out, then fetch her a glass of tap water. Rinse and spit, I say, holding the bowl under her mouth.
Fucking gods, Bob.
Bed. Now.
We killed the bad things, but the little girl with the pigtails, I managed to carry her head back, but it was too late.
She's crying now, and it's all coming out. All the ugly details in a torrent, like a vomiting storm sewer, unloading a decade of pain and bloody shit and piss, and I carry her up the stairs as best I can and tuck her under the duvet. And she's still crying, although the racking sobs are coming further apart. Sleep and remember, I tell her, touching her forehead. Remember, it's all over. I pull my ward over my head and hang it around her neck. Repeat command light paramnesia level 2, 8 hours REM, master override, end it. Then I touch her forehead again. It's over, Mo. You can let go of it now. As I go downstairs to clean up, I hear her beginning to snore. Mopping up vomit and consigning the wreckage of dinner to the recycling bin and the dishwasher keeps me distracted for 10 minutes. But unfortunately not distracted enough to avoid looping through everything Mo said in my mind's eye. I can't help it. I've been through some bad shit myself, similar stuff. I've been through situations where you just keep going, keep pushing through. Because if you stop, you'll never start again. But for all that, this one was particularly horrifying. I think it's the civilian involvement that does it. I'm more or less able to look after myself, and so is Mo, but a primary school. I don't want to think about that, but I can't stop, because this is where we're all going. When the walls of reality come tumbling down, and the dead gods begin to stir in their crypts, it's put me in a theological frame of mind, and I hate that. Let me try to explain. I generally try to avoid funerals. They make me angry. I know the purpose of a funeral is to provide comfort and a sense of closure for the bereaved, but I agree in principle that this is generally a good thing. But the default package usually comes with a priest, and when they start drivelling on about how Uncle Fred, who
who died aged 62 of a hideous brain tumour, is safe in the ever-loving arms of Jesus, the effect it has on me is not to make me love my Creator. It's to wish I could punch him in the face repeatedly. I'm a child of the Enlightenment. I was raised thinking that moral and ethical standards are universals that apply equally to everyone. And these values aren't easily compatible with the kind of religion that posits a creator. To my way of thinking, an omnipotent being who sets up a universe in which thinking beings proliferate, grow old, and die, usually in agony, alone, and in fear, is a cosmic sadist. Consequently, I'd much rather dismiss theology and religious belief as superstitious rubbish. My idea of a comforting belief system is your default English atheism. Except that I know too much. See, we did evolve more or less randomly, and the little corner of the universe we live in is 13.73 billion years old, not 5,000 years old. And there's no omnipotent, omniscient, invisible sky daddy in the frame for the problem of pain. So far, so good. I live free in an uncaring cosmos, rather than trapped in a clockwork orrery constructed by a cosmic sadist. Unfortunately, the truth doesn't end there. The things we sometimes refer to as elder gods are alien intelligences, which evolved on their own terms, unimaginably far away and long ago, in zones of space-time which aren't normally connected to our own, where the rules are different. But that doesn't mean they can't reach out and touch us. As the man put it, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Any sufficiently advanced alien intelligence is indistinguishable from God, the angry, monotheistic, sadist subtype, and the Elder Ones aren't friendly. See? I told you I'd rather be an atheist. I push the button on the dishwasher, straighten up, and glance at the kitchen clock. It's pushing 10:30, but I'm wide awake and full of bleak existential rage. I don't want to go to bed. I might disturb Mo, and she really needs her sleep right now. So I tiptoe upstairs to check on her, use the bathroom, then retreat downstairs again. But that leaves me with a choice between sitting in a kitchen that smells of bleach and a living room that smells of sour fear memories. I can't face the inanities of television or the solace of a book. I feel restless. So I clip on my holster, pull on my jacket, and go outside for a walk. It may be summer, but it's already dark and the streetlights are on. I walk down the leafy pavement between the neatly trimmed front hedges and the sleeping cars parked nose to tail. The lichen-stained walls and battered wheelie bins are stained by the stale orange twilight reflected from the clouds. Traffic rumbles in the distance, pulsing with the freight of the unsleeping city. Here and there I see front windows illuminated from within by the shadow puppet play of televisual hallucinations. I turn a corner, walk downhill under the old railway bridge, then left past a closed back street garage. Cats slink through the moonless twilight with nervous stealth. The smell of night-blooming pollen meshes with the gritty taste of diesel particulates at the back of my throat. I walk through the night, wrapped in my anger, and as I walk, I think, Angleton is missing. Why? And where? He doesn't live anywhere, according to human resources, doesn't have a life. Well, that's not much of a surprise. Angleton's grasp on mundane humanity has always struck me as tenuous. The idea that there's a 400-year-old stone cottage in a village in the countryside, and a Mrs. Angleton puttering around, hanging out the laundry on a line in the back garden, simply doesn't work for me. He goes beyond the usual monasticism of the man who married his job. He never takes holidays. He's always in the office. And then there's the photograph. Maybe he inherited it from Dorian Gray? So, let this be clue number one that something is wrong. Angleton never does anything by accident, so either something is rotten in the state of Denmark, or he's embarked on a caper he didn't see fit to tell anyone about. I turn right, across a main road, quiet at this time of night, then along and left down an alleyway that leads between rows of high back garden fences. Grass grows beneath the crumbling silvery woodwork and around the wheelie bins. Here's a concrete yard where someone has parked a decaying caravan, its windows frosted dark in the urban twilight. The Fuller Memorandum is missing. Whatever is in it is still a hot potato after 70-odd years. Angleton was interested in it, and in Bloody Baron, and in this new business about Case Nightmare Green coming into effect sooner rather than later. Item,
Why are the Russians sniffing around? And what did Panin mean about finding the teapot? He can't be talking about Ungern Sternberg's psychotic Batman, can he? I did some checking. Teapot was fragged by Ungern Sternberg's own rebellious troops in 1921, right before they handed the Baron over to Trotsky's commissars. At least the mutineers said they shot him. If he'd run away into the Siberian forest, alone, might they have concocted some cock-and-bull cover story? I make a right turn into a narrow path. It leads to a tranquil bicycle track, walled in beech and chestnut trees growing from the steep embankments to either side, and sporadically illuminated by isolated lampposts. It used to be a railway line, decades ago, one of the many suburban services closed during the beaching cuts, but it wasn't a commuter line. I stumbled across it not long after we moved to this part of town, and it caught my attention enough to warrant some digging. The Necropolis service ran from behind Waterloo Station to the huge Brookwood Cemetery in Surrey. Tickets were sold in two classes, one way and return. This is one of its tributaries, a tranquil creek feeding the great river of the dead. Today, cyclists use it to bypass the busy main roads on their way into the centre. It is, however, unaccountably unpopular with the after-work exercise set, and I have the left lane to myself as I walk, still chewing over what I know and what I don't know. Club Zero and Mo. Who sent Uncle Fester? I see three alternatives. Panin and his friends, the cultist she was sent to shut down, or some third party. Taking it from the top, Panin is a professional and can be expected to usually play by the rules. Sending a zombie to doorstep an officer in a foreign nation's service at home just isn't done. It's not businesslike. And besides, once you start sending assassins to bump off the Oppo, you've got no guarantee that their assassins aren't going to outperform yours. The reason great powers don't usually engage in wars of assassination is that it levels the playing field. On the other hand, cultists like the perps behind Club Zero are far more likely to do that sort of thing. Assassination and terrorism are Siamese twins, tools for outsiders and pressure groups. So my money is on Uncle Fester being an emissary from the cultists the AIVD called Moen to neutralize. Unless there's a third faction in play, a prospect I find far too scary to contemplate. The cycle path narrows and descends deeper into its cutting. The lights are more widely spaced here, and a number of them are out. Hearing a rustling, scampering sound behind me, I glance round as something flickers in the bushes between lights. Dog-like, with a great bush of a tail. An urban fox? Maybe. I didn't see the ears or muzzle, though. Urban foxes aren't a problem, unless you're a cat, but feral dogs might be another matter. I keep walking in the twilight. London is warm and humid in summer, but down here it's almost clammy cold, and there's a faint whiff of something like a sewer, sweet and slightly rotten. I break into a slow jog, aiming to outrun the stench. I have a growing edgy feeling that I've missed something critically important. I've been ploughing along, in harness and under stress, assuming that the crises I'm trying to deal with are all independent. But what if they aren't? I ask myself. What if Angleton's disappearance is connected to Panin's search for the teapot? What if the Fuller memorandum holds an explanation? What if the cultists know that we stand closer to the threshold of the end times than we realize and are trying to topple the balance, or perhaps to steal? There's a crack of dead branches under the trees behind me. Panting, inhuman breath punctuates the thudding of a four-footed pursuit. The orange sodium glare leeches away around me, giving way to a different shade of darkness. Trees loom overhead, clutching at each other with wizened arms as bony as concentration camp victims. A thin mist at foot level obscures the tarmac path, and my stomach lurches. I'm not running through suburban London anymore. I'm running along the ghostly trackbed of the Necropolitan line, and the hounds of hell are on my trail, and I left my protective ward with Mo, and I am a fucking imbecile. Shit, shit, shit. Whatever the thing behind me is, it's only seconds away. My heart's already thudding uncomfortably from jogging an hour after dinner. Fucking stupid of me. But while I'm 90% sure that I'm being tracked by something that's about as bad as the proverbial hellhound, in which case I really ought to simply plug it with my pistol and ask questions later, I've got an even nastier feeling that it's tracking me for someone, or worse, herding me along. I have a gun, a hand of glory, and a Jesus phone. So of course I draw my phone and flip the case open, thumb swipe to unlock, and spin round, raising the camera to focus as I tap the grinning skull icon. There's method in my madness, and my pursuer isn't mindless. I get a glimpse of flying haunches and bushy tail as it leaps off the path and into the trees with a startled, yip! The screen flashes a red-rimmed maw gaping at me, and my hair stands on end as the phone and my fingertips are engulfed in pale blue fire. Bale fire, it used to be called. I hastily go back to the main screen and stab another app, a diagnostic. Seeing what it says, I swear quietly, and pull up another one that sets a spinning wireframe projection of a 5D tesseract on the screen, as it does its valiant best to set up a ward around me. The dog thing is hiding, and the tendrils of mist draw away from my feet, so I shove the phone in my pocket, still running, and draw my pistol. Then I turn back to the way I was going. The emulator running on the phone's a poor substitute for a real ward, and it's only going to keep it up for as long as its battery can keep its tiny electronic brain running at full power. But armed and warded is the first step to survival. And now I see the peril I'm in with an icy clarity. The second app I looked at was the thermometer, and I should have kept an eye on it earlier as I walked. It's almost off the chart. And all because I'm walking the Necropolitan line. If you wanted to set up a ley line, what better source of power could you hope for than the accumulated grief and sorrow of millions of mourners, to say nothing of the decaying lives of the corpses that travelled it? I should have seen it coming, but I usually only use this cycle path as a shortcut to and from the tube station in daylight. I'm pretty sure I'm being trailed by cultists. When I left home, I was angry in the abstract, but now I am really fucked off. These are the bastards who murdered a bunch of nursery school tots and their teachers, put Mo through the horrors, and they're trying for me now. The only question is, are they chasing me or herding me? I keep going, slowing my jog to a brisk walk, scanning ahead as I move. I hold my gun at the ready with both hands, close to my chest, relying on the invisibility ward to make it look as if I'm just clutching my right wrist with my left hand. The mist at ground level coils and curdles around a pair of translucent parallel rails the colour of old bones, resting on a bed of ethereal track sleepers. The trees writhe and knot overhead, clutching at each other, imploring and beseeching. In the distance I hear odd noises. The ghost of sobbing, deep voices intoning something, words I can't quite make out. I'm sure it's all very eerie, but when reality starts to imitate a second-rate computer game, you know the bad guys have over-egged the pudding. Some fuckhead is hitting me with a glamour in hope of spooking me. It's the sort of tactic that might stand a chance of working if I was a little less cynical, or if they had enough imagination to make it, oh, you know, horrifying or something. Luckily for me, they don't seem to have grasped the difference between a Sam Raimi movie and standing by your dad's hospital bed trying to work up the nerve to switch off the ventilator. So I find the fact that they're sending me woo-woo noises and mist perversely encouraging. I'm having second thoughts about the cultist thing, though. The probability of running into two different cells of the fuckers in the same month is vanishingly slim. And if this nonsense is a message from the same group that tried to landscape downtown Amsterdam last week, they've definitely sent the B-team. I up my pace again, and just then I hear a scraping noise from the embankment to my left, and every hair on my neck stands on end simultaneously. I swing round, extending my arms in front of my face and sliding my index finger through the trigger guard as this thing clatters and scrambles down the side of the cutting in a mad dash towards me, a growl of hatred and hunger sounding an organ note deep in its chest, and I have time to think, I hate fucking dogs, just as it launches itself towards me. I squeeze the trigger twice, aiming below where my eyes are focused on it. I can't look away. I get a flash of bared fangs and slavering tongue, eyeless and horrid and taller than any dog I've ever imagined, and there's a sound like a palm slapping a lump of wet meat as the gun kicks silently in my hand. I jump sideways as it slams into the track sleepers where I was standing a moment ago, howling a scream of agony and snapping those huge jaws at its own shoulder. It's not a dog. Dogs aren't as black as a hole in space, and their musculature and articulation follow mammalian norms. This thing bends wrong as it bites and flails around. and I have an inkling of a memory that tells me I should be very afraid right now. But I'm not. I started out pissed off, and I am now toweringly angry, which is why I walk behind the flailing body, lower my aim towards the back of its skull, and call, "Show yourself right now, or the doggy gets it." There's a low chuckle.
"Give us the teapot, and we will let you live, mortal."
Mortal? Yes, it's the B-team, all right. Probably in robes with upside-down crucifixes or something. They're the occult equivalent of the kind of suicide bombers who post their confession videos on YouTube 2 weeks before they learn the hard way that trying to blow themselves up with chapati flour isn't going to do anything except give the police an excuse to pat themselves on the back and reassure the public that everything is under control. "Come out where I can see you," I demand. The hound thing on the ground whines in agony. It's getting on my nerves, cutting through the barricade of my determination. Then I notice out of the corner of one eye that the shoulder I blew a fist-sized chunk out of is writhing and foaming, dark tubules questing inwards from the ripped and shredded edges. Shit. If this is what I think it is, then by summoning it, the B-team have bitten off more than they can chew. And so have I. "You've got 5 seconds," I add. "It won't die, but it's going to be real pissed off. And I reckon it's 50-50 whether it blames me or blames you."
"Do you truly believe you can shoot one of the hounds with impunity, mortal?"
I've got a bearing on Windbag now. Your typical B-team idiot is either a religious fanatic who's grown up listening to preacher men ranting and foaming in 17th century English, or they're a wannabe who's seen too many horror flicks. I'm betting on the second kind here. I take a step back. Accidental contact with this particular species of doggy is about as safe as licking the third rail on the underground. Then quickly slip my left hand into my pocket and mutter the command word to ignite the hand of glory as I pull it out of my pocket. Of course, the hog lights off promptly, but its little pinky is tangled in my pocket lining and comes free with a foul gust of scorched linen, something else to hold against the gloating rat fucker. I take a long step sideways, then another, holding the wrinkled hand at arm's length out to one side. The Glock is a numbing drag on my opposite arm. Nothing like as bad as a Browning, but I can't keep this up forever. A second voice chirps up from behind the thrashing hound, about where I was standing 5 seconds ago.
"Hey, where'd he go?"
He sounds dim. Let's call him Minion Number One.
"Fuck."
That's Windbag. He sounds pissed off.
"We're going to lose him. All Highest will be displeased."
"I've got the path."
A third voice, female and coldly controlled. Maybe she's an A-team player assigned to ride herd on the clown car. She can be Minion Number Two until proven competent.
"You walk the..."
No plan survives contact with the enemy, especially when the enemy is invisible, within earshot and taking notes. But even more importantly, no cultist survives physical contact with one of the hounds. The doggy of doom flails one paw against the ground and its back arches as it goes into the seizure I've been expecting ever since I plugged it with a banishment round. Which is bad luck for Minion Number One, who is in the path of one viciously barbed paw. He gives a brief gurgling scream, but is already dead by the time the sound reaches me. It's just air venting from the corpse's lungs and reverberating through its larynx on the way out. Every muscle in his body contracts simultaneously with a strange popping sound as his joints dislocate and ligaments tear in a spasmodic breakdance that ends in a pile beside the hound. I don't wait to see what they do next. I scramble up the dry soil embankment, moving diagonally between tree trunks.
"We're going to lose him,"
Minion Number Two calls in a high, bell-ringing voice.
"Fallback plan."
Okay, she's promoted to mistress. I think for a moment that she's telling Windbag to withdraw, but then I hear the second truly spine-chilling noise of the evening, the unmistakable sound of someone racking the slide on a pump-action shotgun. I throw myself flat against the side of the embankment and roll over on my back, still clutching the hand of glory and my pistol, as the two robed figures on the path raise their weapons and pour fire past each other, sweeping up and down the bike path. They set up a reverberating roar that jars the teeth in my head. They're not aiming, they're simply spraying clouds of buckshot at waist level. I'm about 2 meters up the embankment above them, and 20 meters away. Holding my breath, I glance at the hog in my left hand. The fingertips are burning steadily. I have perhaps 3 or 4 minutes of invisibility. Odds of 2 to 1, shotguns against silenced pistol at 20 meters? Not good. I could probably take them. Probably. But I'd have to put the Hand of Glory down, and if I didn't get them both with my first 2 shots, I'd be giving the survivor a muzzle flash to aim for. With a shotgun, let's not forget. Fucking B-team cultists. If this was the A-team, they'd summon something exotic and deadly to set on my ass, something I'd have a chance of banishing. But the B-team were at the back of the queue the day All Highest was handing out death spells, so they just blaze away with shotguns. 10 rounds later, it feels like having my head slammed in a doorway 10 times in a row, they lower their guns.
"He's legged it," says Windbag.
"Right, we're leaving."
Mistress's voice is so chilly you could rent it out as an air conditioner.
"Philip is dead. This will not be received well by All Highest. Let me do the talking if you value your life."
"But can't we..."
Windbag whines. I don't hear what he says next, though, because Mistress says something in a voice that distorts weirdly as she speaks, and then a hole in the air opens and closes, and they're not there anymore. Neither is the hound.
"It's gone, taking the corpse of Minion Number 1 back to wherever it is that the hounds come from."
The glamour is gone too. Below me, the cycle path is restored. Just another rustic suburban alleyway, lit by the streetlight glare from the nighttime clouds overhead. I shudder uncontrollably for a minute. Then I carefully extinguish the fingers of the hog, holster my pistol, stumble back down the embankment to the footpath, and dust myself off. They weren't after Mo. They were after me. They knew how to find me, and they wanted to know about the teapot. Once is happenstance, but twice is enemy action, which means it's time to go to work.
This ends Disc 4.